nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
This talk is about nano devices and Maxwell's demon. So let me briefly explain what I mean by a nano device. What I have in mind is just a generic structure consisting of something we call the channel, that's a conductor, across which we have made two contacts, source and drain. And these typical nano transistors that you have in all your laptops, in your computers, these are all would generically belong to this category of nano devices. Now, these, as you know, each of your computers has about a billion of these transistors in it. And the reason they can fit a billion in there is because the length of the channel is extremely small, you know, typically like hundreds of atoms across. Now, you'd call this a state-of-the-art engineering marvel. Now, usually you do not see nano devices and Maxwell's demon in the same talk because, by contrast, of course, Maxwell's demon is more a physicist's thing, one that people discuss in order to understand or enjoy some of the basic questions of thermodynamics, the basic principles of this second law. You see, back in the 19th century, when thermodynamics was a relatively new subject, people had a lot of, there was a lot of confusion about the nature of heat. You know, today, of course, we all know that heat is basically a form of energy. But in those days, it wasn't really all that clear. And one of the reasons is that although it's a form of energy, you cannot quite convert it entirely into useful work. That is, if you could do that, if you could just take the energy from your surroundings and turn it into useful work, then, of course, you wouldn't have an energy problem. But what the second law says is you cannot do that. You can convert only a part of it. In fact, you cannot convert any of it if it's all at the same temperature. Now, what Maxwell had come up with was a little example to show some of the subtleties of the second law of thermodynamics. He said, well, imagine a demon, I mean, no negative connotation here, just a nanoscale object that knows the velocity of all the molecules in this chamber. As you know, some molecules are fast. Let's say those are the red ones. Some molecules are slow. Those are the blue ones. And what this demon does is he opens the door at the right times to let the red ones go from one side to another, but the blue ones he only lets go on the others, in the other direction. So that after some time, you'd expect that all the red ones would be on one side and all the blue ones would be on the other side. And what that means is, since these are the faster ones, it means this side is hotter than that side. Now, if you could do that, then, of course, what you have done is beaten the second law because you have started from a uniform temperature, a gas at uniform temperature, and created a temperature difference, a hot side and a cold side, which you could then use to run a heat engine, for example. Now, question is, what's wrong with the idea? Because everyone knows that, of course, everyone believes in the second law. They don't really think this could be done. Question is, what's wrong? And that has sparked a lot of discussion over the years. Now, in this talk, though, I'm using this more as an example to illustrate some of the interesting issues, some of the basic issues that you have to deal with when modeling nanoscale devices like that one. And specifically, of course, as I said, in these nanoscale devices, what you can do actually nowadays is design what you might call an electronic demon, one that lets electrons go from one side to another, but not in the other direction. And if you designed it right, what I'll show is you could do something like this, where even when there is no voltage in the external circuit, you could actually get a current to flow through this circuit, which means, you know, you could actually extract useful work out of it. Now, not that we are beating the second law of thermodynamics, and I'll explain why, what the issues are. And as I mentioned, my real purpose here is really to illustrate the basic issues involved in the operation of nanoscale devices. Specifically, what I really want to convey to you in this lecture and the next one is this uniform or the unified viewpoint that we has developed over the last, I guess, 10 to 20 years for all kinds of nanoscale devices. Like even 10 years ago, it wasn't really clear that you could think about silicon nanowires and carbon nanotubes and small molecules all in the within the same framework. But today, it has become clear that actually you could. They all can be described within one common framework, which I have tried to illustrate schematically out here. Because basically, of course, current flow involves an electron getting in from the left onto a channel region and then getting out. And so the basic things that determine whether current can flow or not is the density of states in your channel region and the rate at which electrons can come in and get out. And regardless of what type of conductor we are talking about, fundamentally it is really those three things that determine how well it conducts. Now, a more sophisticated model, which does this in a little more detail, is shown here, which you could call the matrix version of that, in the sense that here we deal with simple numbers, something that tells you how many states you have, how easily electrons get out or get in. Whereas here, what we have is a matrix, a Hamiltonian matrix, whose eigenvalues tell you the energy levels, or these self-energy functions, which are like the matrix versions of these gamma 1 and gamma 2. But in this first lecture, I really will more or less confine myself to the simpler version rather than the matrix version. And I'll try to keep the discussion at a more qualitative level to give you a feeling for the concepts involved. Whereas in the second lecture, I'll get a little more detailed and also explain how one transitions from the simple model into a matrix model. Now, the other point I'd like to stress is that this unified viewpoint that I mentioned not only gives you a uniform way of looking at different materials, but it also gives you a uniform way of looking at different regimes of transport. That is, one thing that's known is that if the length of your conductor is in the region of, say, micrometers, then the flow of electrons through this channel is diffusive, in the sense that it gets scattered and knocked around and performs some kind of a random walk before it gets out the other end. And when you make this channel smaller, then you have what you call ballistic transport, where electrons come in and get out without getting scattered, essentially. And then if you really go to smaller dimensions, you know, like hundreds of angstroms, at that point, the wave nature of electrons also starts playing an important role in determining the flow of electrons. And the model we have here actually covers this entire regime. It covers this entire region from the diffusive regime to the ballistic regime and on to the regime where, you know, of quantum transport. And the way it's covered is that when you're talking about small conductors, then the important thing is these gamma 1 and gamma 2. That is how electrons come in from the contact and how they go out. Whereas when you are at the other end, the interaction with the surroundings plays a very important role. And that's this gamma S. And 20 years ago, you see, when I was a graduate student, devices were relatively much longer. The length regimes that people talked about were somewhere up here. And so the gamma S played a very important role. In fact, before 1990, theorists seldom even talked about the contacts. They seldom drew the contacts because the physics of conduction was all right here in the gamma S. But now that we have come to really small devices, where we are somewhere around here, it really makes more sense to start at the other end, where the important where you start by assuming that the gamma S is zero, that is, you ignore the interaction with the surroundings, and you talk about the contacts, because that's really the most important thing in small devices. But as you change the relative importance of these gamma ones and the gamma S, you can essentially cover the entire regime from the quantum regime over to the diffusive regime. Now, one point I want to stress here is that our whole understanding of how current flows is really what one could call top-down. That is, we usually start at this end and try to work our way downwards, not because that's the logical way to do things, but because that's the way the subject historically evolved. In the sense that 20 years ago, people knew something about the resistance of conductors at this end, but they really had no idea what it would be at this end. And so they naturally started at that end, and they worked their way downwards. So that first thing you learned was conductance depends on something called conductivity. That's this sigma. And the next thing you learn is that the conductivity depends on three things: the electron density, the mean free time, and the effective mass. And from this point of view, of course, when you go to small conductors, you get somewhat confused. Because first thing is, since in a ballistic conductor, electrons don't get scattered, it's not clear what the mean free time is. Now, you could probably use the transit time and get by. But then when you get to smaller conductors, it gets even more confusing. Because when you get to a little molecule between two contacts, it's not clear what the mass is. Because after all, you see, that mass is not the free electron mass. It's this effective mass that comes from knowing the band structure of a solid. And when you have a small molecule like this, it's not clear what effective mass one should use. Actually, it's not even clear what electron density one should use, because that's not the total number of electrons. It's really the number of quote-unquote free electrons. And so question is, you know, which electrons are free, which electrons are not. So the point I'm trying to make is that in this conventional top-down way of thinking, the general consensus is that down here, things get very complicated. But what I believe is that if you start at this end, actually, it's really not so complicated. In fact, what I'll try to do in the next few slides, I'll try to explain what the conductance of something really small is and try to work my way upwards. And roughly, the basic results that I'll try to show, that's summarized in this slide. Namely, what I'll try to show is that when you get to a really small conductor, its conductance is given by this fundamental constant. This is the charge on an electron. That's the Planck's constant. And it comes to approximately the inverse of 25 kiloohms. When you get to bigger devices, it's given by the quantum of conductance times a factor where you have two things that come in, namely the density of states and this, what I call the escape rate, that is, how easily electrons get in and out of the channel. Well, you might say, how does that then connect to Ohm's law? Because after all, conductance should go as A over L, A being the cross-sectional area and L being the length. And after all, when you get to big things, you'd expect that the density of states should go as the volume, which is A times L. Now, the way you can connect this result to Ohm's law is by noting that when you get to a really big diffusive conductor, the time it takes for an electron to actually escape from this channel actually goes as 1 over L square. Now, that, of course, hides a lot of physics that in itself, you know, would take many slides to go through in detail. But I'm sure you have heard this before, that if you have a diffusive medium, then the time it takes for an electron to go across is proportional to L square rather than L. And if you use that, you can see why the conductance goes as A over L. On the other hand, if you had a ballistic conductor, then, of course, the time it takes for an electron to escape would be directly proportional to L divided by the velocity. And in that case, you'd get a conductance that depends only on the cross-sectional area, and it's independent of length. And that's exactly true for ballistic conductors. The people, when they make measurements on ballistic carbon nanotubes, they find that, you know, when you make it twice as long, the resistance doesn't become twice as large. Okay. So from this point of view, then, you can actually understand this entire region from the quantum end all the way to the Ohm's law for large conductors. Now, what I'll try to do in the next few slides, then, is to first explain where this comes from and then how you go from here to here, so that you get a feeling for how this bottom-up view works. And the reason I want to go through this is, of course, finally I want to talk about this Maxwell's demon, but that, of course, is a nano device, and it's much easier to understand if you use this viewpoint rather than the conventional viewpoint, which is why I want to use the first half of my talk to explain to you this viewpoint of how you think about small devices. And then later on, towards the end of the talk, I'll get into Maxwell's demon, specifically the device with a Maxwell's demon in it. Okay. Now, the basic idea is, when you want to understand the current flow through any device, the first thing you do is draw an equilibrium energy level diagram. What that means is, like a hydrogen atom, any material has a set of levels, some of which are filled and some of which are empty. Now, one can argue how you calculate these levels. Should you use DFT? Should you use various types of correction? But that's a question we won't get into. The point in this discussion simply is that you have a set of levels that are filled and a set of levels that are empty. Experimentally, you could measure them with, say, using the photoelectric effect or the inverse photoelectric effect. And the contacts have a set of states that are continuous, which is what I have shown here, because these are large regions. And then you have this electrochemical potential, which divides the filled states from the empty states. Now, will this material conduct? The answer is, it will not conduct as long as there are no states here around the electrochemical potential. Whether something conducts or not depends on the density of states around this energy. And the way I've drawn it, this will not conduct. But then, if you had a gate here, something with which I could change the electrostatic potential in the channel region, then what I can do is use the gate to move these levels up and down. So for example, if I put a positive voltage on the gate, then I can lower all the levels. Anytime you have a positive voltage, these are electron energy levels. Electrons have negative charge. And so a positive voltage actually moves the levels down. And now we have states around the electrochemical potential, and so it will conduct. Now, if you put a negative voltage, you can raise all the levels. And now you again have states right around the electrochemical potential, and again it should conduct. So that's how you could actually control how well a particular structure conducts or not conduct. Now the next question is, why is it that it's the density of states around the electrochemical potential that determines whether something conducts or not? Why is it not dependent just on the total number of electrons in there, for example? Well, to answer that question, you could think about why current flows through something. The way I'd say it is that when you apply a voltage, what you do is when you put a positive voltage here, you lower all the energy levels in this contact along with the electrochemical potential. So that we now have two different electrochemical potentials, one in the left contact, one in the right contact. And what this contact tries to do, of course, is to fill up these levels. Why? Because these levels are below the electrochemical potential, and it's kind of like the level of water, that what this would like to do is fill up all these states whose energy is less than mu 1. On the other hand, this contact, of course, would like to keep those states empty, because these levels have an energy that's greater than mu 2. And so what happens is, this contact keeps putting in electrons, and this contact keeps pulling them out. And of course, once they're out here, there's an extra electron which gets pulled out by the battery, and the battery feeds back another electron, and that's why the current just keeps flowing. Now, that looks pretty obvious, actually, and of course, you can see that you would have the same situation if you're going through these filled states. You take out one electron and then fill it up again. And as I say, this looks simple, but it actually causes a lot of discussion and debate, because sometimes people say, well, when you put a voltage, of course, you have an electric field, and if you have an electric field, all these electrons should start moving. But the point is, no, current flow does not depend on all these electrons. The current flow is only determined by those levels that lie between mu 1 and mu 2. And the reason is that if you look at these levels, the point is this contact wants to keep them filled because they are below mu 1. This contact also keeps them filled because they are below mu 2. So they just stay filled. That's all. So nothing happens. I mean, no current flows. I mean, both contacts wants to keep them filled. They stay filled. End of story. Nothing else happens. By contrast, of course, these levels, the reason current flows is because the two contacts have two different agendas. One wants to fill them up. One wants to empty them. And so current keeps flowing. One fills them up. The other empties it. That's how it goes. Okay. Now we can try to see what we'd expect for the current voltage characteristic of a very small conductor which has just one level in the energy range of interest. As I mentioned, anything way outside here or up there doesn't matter. What matters is those levels that are around mu 1 and mu 2. So question is, what would the IV characteristic look like? Well, if you put a negative voltage in here and started raising this, at first no current would flow because this level is outside this window. But once you have raised mu 2, so the level comes within the window, that's when current will flow. And so if you plotted the current versus voltage, it would look something like this. That when you turn up the voltage, at first no current flows, and then after some time the current steps up. And you can show that the maximum value of the current through this one level is given by this E, which is the charge on an electron, and gamma 1 over H bar. That's the rate at which electrons come in and go out. Gamma has the dimensions of energy. When you divide by h bar, the dimension is per second. So the charge on an electron times gamma over h bar, that tells you the current. And you have this 2 here because there's these two junctions in series. So the actual rate is like half of what it is through one of these. Okay, so that's a current versus voltage characteristic. Now, question is, what does the conductance look like? Now, as you know, conductance is the derivative of the current versus voltage. So you have current versus voltage. If you look at the derivative, out here it's 0. Out here it's 0. But in here, that's when the current changes. That's where the derivative is non-zero. And the question is, how much is that conductance? Well, you'd say that the conductance is given by this current. That's the amount by which the current changes, which is this, divided by the voltage range over which that change takes place. The question is, what is that voltage range? And your first guess would be that that voltage range should be of the order of kT over E. Because, as you know, these Fermi functions at room temperature are spread out by an amount of the order of kT. And so you'd think that the amount of the voltage you need to change the current is of the order of kT. Now, if you do that, then of course you'd say that as you go to zero temperature or very low temperatures, the conductance should get extremely large. And of course, one of the seminal results of mesoscopic physics, you see, something that wasn't known 20 years ago, but now is pretty well established, is that when you go to something really small, there is an upper limit to the conductance. It does not increase indefinitely as you lower the temperature. And the question is, why is that? And the answer is that, you see, when you connect contacts to a level, the level broadens out. And this is a fundamental result of quantum mechanics. We could call it this uncertainty principle, that an energy level is sharp only as long as you do not connect to it. But if you connect to it, it will also broaden by an amount of 2 gamma 1, so that the voltage range over which the current changes is not just 4 kT, but to that you have to add this 2 gamma 1, this fundamental broadening of the energy level. And what that means is that when you go to low temperatures, you can ignore this, but the gamma cancels out, and the maximum value of the conductance you'd get is this E squared over 4 H bar. And the correct answer, I mean, if you took care of the constants carefully, you'd actually get E squared over 2 pi H bar, which is this result that I'd mentioned before, this 1 over 25.8 kilo ohms. Now, this is a result, as I say, 20 years ago was not known at all. Since 1990 has been known, but usually you think of this as a very special result for quantum point contacts where you have just the right kind of contact. But the point I'd want to emphasize here is that this is really far more general. And recent experiments on very small molecules actually establishes that. Like I took this out of an experimental paper from a few years back, where they actually had a hydrogen molecule strung between two platinum contacts. And when they measured the conductance, they actually find it's about this 2E squared over H. Oh, by the way, that 2 comes from the 2 spins, because in my discussion, I've been ignoring spins. As you know, levels usually come in pairs. There's for every up spin, there's usually a down spin. And that's why this number is like twice what I've been saying. But the point I really want to make is that this is really a very fundamental thing that comes from the fact that whenever you connect to a level, you also broaden it. It's a consequence of that and is really quite general. Okay. Now, another point I'd like to mention here is that when you think about the current voltage characteristics, you know, often you hear that how do you design a molecule to get a particular current voltage characteristic? And I'd like to stress that what you get often depends on the electrostatics of the problem. That is, depending on the electrostatics, the same molecule, and we are assuming a very simple molecule which just gives you one level in your energy range of interest, could give you current voltage characteristics that look like this, where you get a current in this direction, but none in this direction, or it could be symmetric, which conducts in both directions, or it could be just the opposite, where it conducts only in this direction. All these IV characteristics are possible from the same molecule having just one level, depending just on the electrostatics of the problem. To see that, let's assume first that this level is fixed, so that when I put a voltage here, this level does not move. Now, in that case, what I'd expect is that when I put a voltage in this direction, I'm pulling this mu 2 down, and since this level is outside the mu 1, mu 2 window, it cannot conduct, and so I do not get any current. On the other hand, if I put a voltage in the opposite direction, then I raise mu 2, and at first no current flows, but then when I put enough voltage, I cross the level, and that's when current starts flowing. So you can see how you might expect a current voltage characteristic looking like that. But note here, of course, what I have assumed is that the level does not move when I apply a voltage here. The more likely what would happen is when you put a voltage here, the level itself will also move. So that what will happen is when I pull this contact down, I'll also pull that level down with it. And when the level comes down here, it will actually start conducting. And you can show that in that case, you would actually get a symmetric IV where current would flow in either direction. So this is a point I wanted to stress, that electrostatics can play a very important role in terms of determining the current voltage characteristics of small objects, actually of any conductor, really. And this is something we had shown about 10 years back, where we were trying to understand the current voltage characteristics of some self-assembled monolayers, and using the standard theory, we were getting rectifying characteristics. Whereas when we took the electrostatics properly into account, we'd have this symmetric IV. Now, the same principle, though, is not just molecules. It's a very important principle even in, say, regular nanotransistors. Nanotransistors, as you know, have a density of states where you have a bottom, that's the conduction band edge, and then you have a non-zero density of states above it. And what it requires some analysis that I won't go into, but the point I want to make is that if you have a very good gate, which is, of course, the ideal if you're trying to make a good transistor, then you'd get an IV characteristic that looks like this, which saturates in this direction. Because as you pull the voltage down, you cross this band edge, and the current doesn't increase thereafter. In the opposite direction, it increases without limit, but usually people use only this part. But the point is that if the gate were not good, if it could not hold up this density of states, then you'd actually have a current voltage characteristics that would be more symmetric and would not really saturate so nicely. And the biggest challenge in designing good transistors is to design good gates so that you get things like this and not things like that. But the point I wanted to make here is, again, that there is no fundamental difference between, say, silicon nanotransistor like this and the simple molecules that I talked about before. It's the same basic principles. And finally, the real point is that when you have a density of states and you apply a voltage, you have to take into account the fact that when you put a voltage here, you actually shift the density of states by a certain amount, which has to be calculated self-consistently. Now, let's move on then to what the conductance would be in a structure with just any arbitrary density of states. You know, what we had before, what I showed was that the current going through one, if you just had one state, one level, would be this E gamma over 2H bar. Now, if you have a continuous density of states like this, then you could say, well, how many states do I have in this window between mu 1 and mu 2? And that number would be D times the applied voltage. And that then gives you this conductance expression, that is I over V of the conductance quantum times this density of states times the escape rate. This is the expression that I had shown you earlier, and you can see how it comes about in this way of thinking. Now, how do you calculate current versus voltage? Well, if your density of states is not constant, but is actually varying with energy, then the expression gets a little more complicated. You have to include this Fermi functions as a function of energy. You have to include the density of states as a function of energy. And the expression I had on the previous slide, you'll get it if you assume that this is constant and pull it out of the integral. Then you'd get what we had before. But in general, then, this is what the current expression would look like. And you can see that the energy range that actually matters is the energy range where the Fermi function in the left contact is different from the Fermi function in the right contact. So in the left contact, you know, this axis is energy. That's the Fermi function. It's 0 above mu 1, and it goes to 1 below mu 1. Whereas F2, it's like 0 above mu 2 and goes to 1 below mu 2. And when I look at F1 minus F2, I have a little function here that's 0 everywhere except in that window between mu 1 and mu 2. And current flow is basically because of all the density of states that lie in this window. So that expression sort of summarizes what I've been saying qualitatively for the last few slides. Now, one interesting thing that comes out of this is you can have current flow not just because of the voltage applied, but also because of temperature. So for example, if you had a conductor across which there is no voltage, so you have the same chemical potential both places, but one of them is at a higher temperature than the other, then what would happen is F1, that's the Fermi function in contact 1, would look something like this, whereas F2 would look something like this. It's much more smoothed out because the temperature is higher. So when I look at the difference between the two, you'd get a negative number, F1 minus F2, above mu 1. In this region, it's negative. But in this region, F1 minus F2 is a positive number. So when you look at this factor, it changes sign right around the chemical potential. Now, what that means is that if your density of states looks something like this, where the bottom is somewhere here and you have a non-zero density of states above it, then you'll have current flow in one direction. Whereas if the density of states looks something like this, then you'd have a current flow in the opposite direction. And the reason is really quite clear. It's just that F1 minus F2 changes sign from here to there. And this would be then what you'd call a thermoelectric effect, you know, something that allows you to take temperature differences and convert it into current flow. And in large conductors, that's a well-known thing. People call it the Seebeck coefficient. But the point I wanted to make here is that you expect it for small things just as well. In fact, for small things, it's much easier to understand the mechanism behind it. Because, as I said, it basically just comes from the fact that this factor changes sign right here. And recently, there's been an experiment. This is like a couple of months old. Earlier this year, this was published in Science, where it's a very difficult experiment that was done by a group at Berkeley, where they strung a molecule between two contacts, applied a temperature differential, and showed that as the temperature was increased, the voltage they measured gradually increased. And they could interpret it based on this simple theoretical model that we had presented earlier. And from that, they could deduce that the conduction through these molecules, at least, was actually through the filled levels rather than the empty levels. And that has been a point of contention for a long time, because it's not known from other sources whether in these molecules which levels actually contribute to the conduction process. And this experiment actually helps settle some of those questions. But in this context, of course, the main point I wanted to make is all this comes out nicely from our simple theoretical picture. Okay, so now I'd like to go on to the second part of the talk, essentially. Now, the model that I've presented to you so far, one reason that makes it simple, relatively, is that the process of dynamics and dissipation are well separated. Now, what I mean by that is, you see, the way we are thinking is, electron comes in from the channel into the, from the contact into this channel, and then goes out to the other contact. Now, you could ask that you have a resistance here that we have calculated. So where is the power dissipated? You know, there's an I squared R loss that we associate with current flow. And the answer is that all the loss, all this dissipation actually takes place in the contacts. Because, you see, when the electron comes out here, it actually has a lot of excess energy relative to the sea of electrons in that contact. And what we assume, just by stating it, that what we assume is that these electrons, through various scattering processes, get rid of this extra energy and sink into this Fermi sea. And similarly, this little empty spot that's filled, that's left behind here, gets filled up by electrons coming in here. And so here again, this much energy gets dissipated by each electron. So the electron really dissipates all this energy in the contacts. And this entire process of dissipation, which can be quite complicated, we have sort of bypassed the physics of that process completely, simply by legislating that the contacts are always maintained in thermal equilibrium with certain Fermi functions. And that's why you have this nice clean separation, that there inside the electrons travel according to some dynamical equation. Like classically, it could be Newton's law. Quantum mechanically, it could be Schrodinger equation. And all the dissipation occurs at the ends. And you could call this, what's called the Landauer model. So you see, almost 50 years ago, Landauer had proposed this more as a conceptual tool for understanding current flow. But nowadays, in nanoscale devices, it has a special relevance, because a lot of real nanoconductors seem to follow this model quite well, in the sense that in carbon nanotubes, people say that with the voltages people apply, if all the heat were actually dissipated inside, it would have burnt up. And people believe that the reason it doesn't burn up is because the heat is largely dissipated in the contacts, which are big regions and can easily get rid of that heat. Now, actually, of course, lots of, real conductors, at least bigger conductors, don't have this clean separation between dynamics and dissipation. It's all mixed up. That is, electrons, as they go through this channel, they lose some energy. And that is what is described by this gamma S, this process by which they lose this energy. And as I mentioned earlier in my talk, when I was a graduate student, when people talked about conductance and, you know, resistance and current flow, they always focused on this, because this was what resistance was all about in those days. Whereas today in the small conductors, as I said, a lot of the physics is actually at the ends. And so earlier, of course, there was a lot of work on how to include such dissipative processes. And 100 years ago, Boltzmann showed how to take Newton's law and incorporate dissipation into it. And that, of course, caused a lot of controversy in its days, because there were a lot of very subtle issues involved. And I'd say that what Boltzmann did for Newton's law, this NEGF, that's this non-equilibrium Green function method that we use, essentially, the NEGF does the same for the Schrodinger equation. It incorporates this dissipation into it. And the model and the earlier work on NEGF tended to focus on the scattering processes inside the conductor, whereas what we now use could be called a Landauer NEGF model, or NEGF-Landauer model, which not only has dissipation inside the conductor, but also includes the contacts in the story. Now, what I'd like to talk about, though, next is this Maxwell's demon that I mentioned before. Now, in general, of course, you always have all kinds of dissipative processes. But what I wanted to show was that if you had a properly designed quote-unquote demon, which was out of equilibrium with your channel, then it could actually do useful work. Of course, it would be described in much the same way as other scattering processes, because what the demon does is essentially interacts with the electrons and exchanges energy with them. But as I said, when properly designed, it can actually lead to not just not to dissipation, but actually to useful work that you could use outside to do useful things. But in order to do that, though, we need to design the device a little differently so that you have two sets of states, one that you could call the red states and one that you could call the blue states. And what the demon does is it takes electrons from the red ones and puts them and turns them blue. And the blue ones then, we assume, can get out through the right-hand contact, whereas the red empty spot that is left behind gets filled up from the left-hand side. So in that sense, what happens is every time the demon takes an electron from here and puts it out there, you actually have a current flow in the external circuit. And that is, in order to make that happen, though, you need these two groups of states, one that connects to the left-hand side well and one that connects to the right-hand side well. And that really is the essence of all energy conversion style devices. I mean, that's how a solar cell works too, that the sunlight takes electrons from the valence band, puts them into the conduction band, and then it comes out one side and gets filled up from the other side. And what I'll try to show here in general, I'll try to describe to you a device which does just this, and you can see how the demon could actually give you useful work in such a structure. Now, the way one could make such a device would be the same basic structure that we had talked about, a channel with a source and a drain. And it's just that the source and drain contacts are magnetic. And such devices are actually used widely. These are called spin valve devices. And they are often used actually as readers in magnetic disks. But here, what I'll assume is an ideal contact such that the source only lets spin of one type. There's an upspin and a downspin. Here I've kind of represented them as red and blue. So it only lets red spins go in and out of the channel, whereas the other contact only lets the blue spins go in and out of the channel, which means left to itself, in this structure, when you apply a voltage, there would be no current at all. No current because red ones can come in but can't get out. Blue ones can get out, but then they can't come in. So there is really no path for electrons to go through this structure, and so you'd have no current. Now, in the real world, of course, people still don't have such perfect contacts. There's a lot of work on trying to get very good contacts, ideally perfect contacts, but usually they are somewhat imperfect in the sense that they are 90% more efficient or 70% more efficient at letting red ones get in and out than blue ones. But they are not quite 100% more efficient as I have assumed here. Now, for such imperfect devices, you would actually have some current flow. But since in this discussion I'm trying to focus on the conceptual aspects, let's assume a perfect structure. So you actually have no current flow then. Now, if in such a structure you had a set of impurities, these could be some paramagnetic impurities, like if it's a silicon channel, these could be these PB centers, somewhere where you have localized spins so that when electrons in the channel can interact with them and can flip their spin. Now, if you had such spin flip impurities, then what you'd expect is a current should flow. In fact, this is well known, which is why when people make spin valves, they try their best to get rid of such impurities, because ideally they would like to have no current, but when you have such impurities, you'd actually get a current. And the reason you'd get a current is that, think of, let's say a red electron comes in from the source. The point is there's a blue impurity there, and the red and the blue can interact and turn blue and red. So from here, it can go to this. just through the usual exchange interaction between those pins. And once it's blue, of course, it can come out of the drain contact, and so current can flow. And the same is true in the other direction as well. You could have blue electrons come in, interact with the red impurities, again, flip their spin, become red, and go out through the source. And so you'd expect a current flow to be possible. Now, the question is, what happens if we arrange it so all the impurities are red up there? Well, you see, then what would happen is these processes where you have a red electron injected from the source, they do not have any blue impurities to flip off of. And so these processes are completely out of the picture. And what that means is no current can flow for that direction of voltage. So if you have a voltage, a positive voltage on the drain, so that electrons are actually getting injected from the source, the point is no current will flow. In the opposite direction, of course, current can still flow, because in the opposite direction, you're injecting blue electrons, and they can flip off the red impurities. On the other hand, if your impurities were all blue, like I've shown here, then what would happen is you'd just have the reverse situation. You have a situation where these processes are completely out. The blue electrons have no impurities to flip off of, but the red impurities can flip, and so you'd actually get a current in the opposite direction. So you'd expect a current voltage characteristic looking something like this. So this is what you'd call a rectifying current voltage characteristic. And this is what you get at zero temperature. Now, when you raise the temperature at a higher temperature, like at room temperature, what happens is that this cusp that you see in this current voltage characteristic, it gets rounded out. So if you do this calculation, and it's a fairly straightforward calculation, actually, if you do this, you'd get curves looking something like this. That is, instead of this sharp cusp here, you'd see this rounded out curve looking like that. And instead of this sharp one here, you'd see a rounded out curve looking like that. And this is current versus voltage. And the important point I want to make here is that if you now look carefully, you'll see that you actually have zero voltage, but there's a non-zero current in either case. In one case, it's in one direction. In the other case, it's in the opposite direction. And this is kind of reminiscent of this Maxwell-Deemann that I had mentioned before, which, you know, lets electrons go in one direction but not the other. And so you can see the connection now. You see, when you do not have any voltages, so the channel has both red electrons and blue electrons all running around. And what this Deemann does, and you can think of these as kind of like the blue eyes of the Deemann, he looks at these electrons, and then whenever he sees a red one, he turns it into blue. And so he takes a red one, flips it into a blue, and then the blue one goes out of the drain contact, and then there's a red one that comes in from the source. And so a current flows in the external circuit, which is kind of like what the classical Maxwell's Deemann was supposed to do. You know, let red molecules go in one direction, blue molecules go in the other direction. Now, of course, this doesn't go on forever, because every time current flows, you see, you have gone from this all blue state into with a one red. And the next time, of course, there'll be two reds. And after some time, of course, there'll be no further current, because there'll be as many blues as reds, which means you'd have as much going one way as the other. Eventually, of course, the current flow stops. But the question is, where did this energy come from? Because if you think about it, these are non-interacting spins. So when it was all blue, whatever energy they had, when it is half red and half blue, it's really the same energy. And yet, the point is a current flows for some time, and in principle, you could have used this to light up a light bulb, for example. So when it is in this state, there'll be current flow, and you could actually have useful work out of it. Now, eventually, of course, it would all die down. But the question is, where did all this energy come from? And if you analyze it carefully, actually what you see is, it actually comes from the contacts. Because what you can show is that the electron actually absorbs energy from this contact and lets out some of it in this contact, but it absorbs more than it lets out. And the difference is what is getting out here as useful work. Now, does that make sense? Well, after all, if you think about it, this is exactly what the second law says you cannot do. Because the second law says that although there is all this energy around you, with all these molecules running around, you cannot just take energy from your surroundings and run your car. Because if you could do that, there would be no energy problem. But here you almost seem to be doing that. You seem to be taking heat from your contacts and doing the equivalent of running your car. Now, what's the reason this is not against the second law is that although these two have the same energy, they do not have the same entropy, in the sense that all blue is a very special state which has a zero entropy, because there's only one way a collection of spins can be all blue, whereas a collection of spins can be half blue and half red in many, many ways. And so that is a state that has a very high entropy. And what second law says is, if the entropy increases by a certain amount, then you can extract an energy up to T delta S. At zero temperature, you couldn't extract any energy from it. And of course, if you remember back, at zero temperature, we did not have any current for zero voltage. It's only at higher temperatures that you get it. And what you can show is that it's within what the second law permits. One last point here is that when going from this all blue state to this random state, you know, as it turns down, no energy is needed. You don't have to supply any energy. It happens automatically. In fact, you can extract energy from it. On the other hand, if you want to go the other way, you actually have to spend some energy. In fact, for example, you could put a battery here and flood the channel with blue electrons, and these will then interact with the impurities and turn them back to all blue and sort of kind of charge up this thing so that it's again ready to do useful work. And it's this process that actually takes energy. Now, one thing that you might ask is, couldn't we arrange things like in a magnet so the system automatically wants to be in an all blue or all red state? You see, so far we have been considering non-interacting spins, which want to be half up and half down, or half red and half blue. But in a magnet, what happens is these spins interact with each other, and there is an interaction which wants to keep them either all blue or all red. Those are the low energy states. And to be half red and half blue actually costs energy. So you might say, well, that would be a good way to, you know, get this thing to always want to be all blue by itself, instead of our previous situation where left to itself, it wants to become like that. And that's true. And in fact, if you used a magnet, it actually costs energy to flip a blue into red. And of course, if it cannot get rid of this extra energy, then after some time, it would all become random and it wouldn't work very well. But what you could do is you could have a cooling system so that the daemon can get rid of this extra energy. So when it's here, left to itself, if it can dissipate, it would get rid of the extra energy and come back down here. And it would always be want to be blue. Well, then you might say you could run this device for a long time, because left to itself, it just comes down. All you have to do is make sure that the daemon can get rid of the extra energy. And that's kind of true, but again, it really doesn't go against the second law, because what you really have then is a structure like this. Like we had before, there is this magnet in here, that's the daemon, which is maintained at a temperature which is lower than the surroundings. So your electron, the source, and drain, let's say those are all at room temperature, and what you have is a way of cooling this magnet down to low temperatures. Then what you can show is that, yes, indeed, you could run this forever. You could take heat from the contacts and give up a part of it, and then take this, give up a part of it right here to the magnet, and then the difference would come out as useful work. But what you can show here is that at the end of the day, it would obey this Carnot's principle, that it would always obey this inequality which defines how much useful work you can actually extract out of, you know, a system with two reservoirs at two different temperatures. That's this basic principle of heat engines. And you could do the reverse. Any heat engine can always be run in reverse as a refrigerator. You could show that if you had a magnet here which wants to be all down, and the heat from the surroundings wants to flip some of them up into reds, and if you inject electrons from this drain which are blue, which kind of bring these reds back into blue, then what would happen is effectively you'd be using this battery to cool the magnet, and you could kind of run it as a refrigerator. Okay. Now, how do you model such things? Now we want to connect back to this unified viewpoint of devices that I had started with. You know, the main purpose of all this was to give you a qualitative feeling for how different nanoscale devices work and the fundamental physical principles that need to be captured in any nanoscale device model. And as I had mentioned before, the basic model that we have is this density of states with how electrons come in, how electrons go out, and how they interact with the surroundings. And the matrix version of that is where these numbers become matrices, but essentially the same physics, of course. Now, what we showed was usually, of course, the surroundings are assumed to be always kept at equilibrium with a certain temperature. And in general, you know, that the daemon, the surroundings could be at a different temperature, in which case it could be used as a heat engine. You could do useful things with it. So there's all kinds of interesting nanoscale devices you could describe. But all that can be covered within this same basic model. Now, one type of device that requires a little extension of the model is what I call these, a good example of that is the spin torque devices, where what happens is that when you run enough current through it, you can actually flip this magnet into the opposite state. So rather than being in equilibrium around this particular equilibrium point, it can actually go over to a different state. And in order to capture this, I mean, this is a particular type of device that's being widely studied nowadays, because what it can do is you might start with an IV that looks like this, and then when it flips over, it can actually, the blue IV can become the red IV, and that's of great interest from the point of view of switching devices. You know, all these computers have millions of switches in them, and a very big question nowadays is how one can construct switches that will not get as hot, because as you know, your laptops feel really hot, and the big problem is to design switches that can operate with less energy. So such devices are of great interest nowadays, and to describe switches like this, what you have to do is supplement the basic current flow model with a separate equation that describes the dynamics of the magnet or the dynamics of the daemon. And of course, this is a paradigm for all kinds of things that you could want to couple your device to. It could be a magnet, it could be a motor, it could be a NEMS device. But the point is you'd have to supplement your current flow model with something that describes the dynamics of what you're coupling it to. So let me now just briefly summarize then that what we have today is a uniform way, a unified way of looking at all kinds of devices, you know, silicon nanowires, carbon nanotubes, molecules. There's a unified way of thinking about it, because the essence of current flow, of course, is there's a density of states, there's a electrons have to come in, they have to go out, and they interact with their surroundings. And the surroundings do not necessarily have to be in equilibrium. You could have a separate equation that describes the dynamics of the surroundings. And this model also describes transport in all these different regimes, from diffusive to ballistic on to quantum transport regime. And one of the very important things that you have learned in course of this is, of course, the importance of contacts. Because I'd stressed before that 20 years ago, theorists didn't even draw the contacts. Whereas now, the experiments of mesoscopic physics kind of forced people to take into account the nature of these contacts explicitly. And that has kind of led us to a much better understanding of this process of current flow. And in my next lecture, what I'll try to do is give you a little more of the flavor of the details of this model and how it works. And I'll also try to explain some of the limitations of this model, the kind of things that you still cannot handle, what I'd call in the category of correlated or entangled contacts. That is, there is evidence that there are all kinds of experiments where the contacts, the state of the contact gets correlated with the state of the channel. And I'd say that at this time, we don't yet have a good way of modeling such devices. So that's what we'll be talking about then in the next lecture. Thank you.